Now we're in depth on why white middle-income, middle-aged Americans choose not to vote. Yes, that was the revelation in a New York Times analysis of non-voters, and it's a revelation because we're used to hearing about the voting potential that young Americans and younger voters of color squander every election season. But the Times found that there are lots of white adults who identify as middle class who took a pass on the 2012 election and may take a pass on this one, too. And we're going to ask why. That's what we're digging into this hour. I think your perspective will inform the conversation. And by the way, I want to let you know that the Times analysis declared that upper Midwesterners are model voters. So a lot of us do vote. Want to hear from those of you who are a little squishy about that, who maybe didn't turn out and vote over the last few presidential elections. If you fit that category, white, middle-aged, middle class, you're not compelled to vote. Tell me why. Here's a question for the rest of us. Does high turnout really matter? So if you're not a voter, you sit out the elections, tell me about why. And for the rest of us, does high turnout in these elections really make a difference? If so, why? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest to talk about this today, Jan Leakley, is a professor of government at American University, where she studies voter patterns, and she's the author of Who Votes Now? And she's with us today from Washington. Jan, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Kerri.
Rob Griffin joins us. He's a senior policy analyst for progressive studies at the Center for American Progress, and he's with us from D.C. as well. And Rob, welcome to you. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Kerri.
Rob, were you feeling a little upset when I said that Midwesterners are model voters, and I did not mention Washington, D.C.?
Oh, not at all, no. No, I mean, Minnesota has a great voting record.
It does, doesn't it? That's why this really puzzles me of everything. This is not what I expected. Jan, what overall, we're going to dig into some of the numbers here, but overall, what's your analysis of this at first blush?
Well, I think the shift from talking about who votes and in the different demographic categories is an important one in talking about what do those non-voters look like, right? And most of what we know is non-voters aren't motivated to vote by their level of interest or political knowledge or other negative feelings about politics, which is probably not surprising given the nature of the election this year and in many other years as well.
Yeah, I can't argue with that, but what I'm curious about, Jan, is whether these are voters who have been somehow turned off by a specific election or who have just never been engaged and don't see a good reason to get engaged.
I think it's the latter in terms of studying and understanding participation in presidential elections. My work with Jonathan Nagler focuses on presidential elections from 1972 through 2008. And the same observation can be made with very little change about levels of turnout. And there have always been a group of white middle-class voter individuals who choose not to vote. So we've never had the glory days of 100% turnout, if you think of that as a glory day. But the perhaps interesting thing is that level of turnout has not changed dramatically for the white middle-class voter, over the past 30, 35 years.
You know, Rob, I was surprised to see that the Times analysis comes from a 2012, which is the presidential election. I know there's big drop-off in midterms. What's your sense about whether these are voters who just nothing is really going to entice them into participating in an election? Is that who most of these people are?
Oh, I don't know if that's who most of these people are. A lot of the times when we talk about why people don't vote, it really has to do with structural or institutional reasons. So even sort of, let's say, the makeup of, how the U.S. does its elections, right? People don't necessarily feel motivated to turn out in places where the outcome is already decided. Places like California and Texas, there's these huge states where, people don't necessarily feel the need to vote. So I don't think there was anything in particular about 2012 that was, people were just, disenchanted or something like that. We just see natural ebbs and flows sometimes in elections.
You just mentioned Texas and California, which are states that have high Latino populations. And I was surprised to read this, that the number of Latinos that are not voting is also rising. Now, some of that is because the Latino population in some of these states is pretty young. But some of it is, at, I guess, as you say, Rob, that they are in states where we know California is going to go blue, right? And they don't. And what is this? They don't feel like their vote would really matter, would have an impact.
Right. So there. So there's the case where they wouldn't necessarily feel that their vote would have an impact. But it's also the case that campaigns don't activate them. You know, we spend a lot of money getting people out to vote in states where it's very, very close during presidential elections. And that has an effect.
Take a call here from Ethan in Owatonna. Hi, Ethan. What's your thought on this?
Well, a couple of things I wanted to mention. I think younger voters don't necessarily want to go out and vote because they, like you guys just said, they don't feel or maybe something isn't represented in what they want to believe. And another thing I wanted to mention was just because Trump and Hillary were nominated for the parties that be, doesn't mean we have to vote for those people. If people still want to support Bernie Sanders, for instance, you still can do that, and he still could be president based on that vote.
Yeah, okay. So, Ethan, that's an interesting point. And, Jan, he's kind of talking, he's bringing up this, the disappointment that a lot of the younger voters, millennials, were seeing still trying to figure out if they can, you know, get over Bernie Sanders not being nominated and turn votes to Hillary Clinton.
Right. I think the key, though, is to think of it, if you can get the younger potential voters to think about it, not in terms of personality or a history with the candidate, but instead an evaluation or sense of what policies they can choose from when they're choosing those candidates who are on the ticket. So the obvious contrast is between what policies Trump might offer to pursue versus what Clinton pursues. We've already seen Clinton, I think, at least discuss more of the issues that younger individuals
exactly.
have been interested in and trying to court them and make a connection. But I think the thing younger voters need to think about is even if they believe in their state or their locale that, you know, the outcome is determined because of a lack of competitiveness or that maybe Clinton is a shoe-in to win, as some people from time to time say, right? If Clinton, if the winner knows that the youth were at the table when those votes are cast, you have to believe that they would continue to consider younger people part of their coalition, part of the group that they need to be responsive to over the next 4 years.
Rob, I think that's a really compelling argument. I wonder if semi-disengaged voters would, you know, what the answer would be to that, if they would buy that.
You know, I think that's part of it, but especially when we talk about the young being disengaged, you know, this is sort of something we talk about almost every election cycle. It's that can we get the youth turnout up?
That's right.
And that'd be great. But there's also reasons, again, why we see lower turnout among young people. Voting is a habit and we gain it over time. You know, it's something where you have to learn how to register to vote. You have to learn where your voting booth is. You have to be pinned down in the same place, for example. You know, young people are very mobile. So they're moving to a new state, and sometimes it takes a couple of years to get re-registered and figure out your new place. So, you know, it's a good goal to have higher, you know, youth turnout. That's a very admirable goal. But it's also, just to be realistic about it, it's probably always going to be lower than people who are a little bit older.
Yeah, but the reason we're having this conversation today, having had many conversations about what it would take to turn out more younger voters, is because in this analysis, it's middle-income, middle-aged Americans who are choosing not to vote, Rob. Not, I mean, this cohort that we're talking about are not the usual voters that don't turn out.
Well, I guess I think this is something Jan had been saying, is historically they have had turnout rates that look just about like this. They're not necessarily in decline, but it's something where this is a group that's always sort of not turned out to vote.
And Jan, are these people, let's set aside the younger voters for a minute, are more of these middle income, middle aged voters who are not voting, are they people who say, I can't affect the outcome, they're not talking about my issue, you know, some cynicism and great disappointment with how the electoral system happens?
Well, that surely what we see in a lot of the polls, right, on the attitudes and high level of cynicism and distrust of government, that we live in a period in which the government just doesn't have much in the way of legitimacy or engagement. But that's what candidates are supposed to do, and political parties, to reach out and try to make that linkage, that if the individual doesn't see an obvious good choice or consider that it's worth their time, that's what those campaigns are supposed to be doing, is portraying that message.
You know, earlier this month, we talked about how education influences voting behavior, Jan. Would that be a factor here, do you think, if we were going to lay that over this graph that we looked at in the Times and the studies that you look at? Would we see education as a factor, too?
Sure. We've education and income are the big factors that seem to most strongly describe differences between who votes and who doesn't vote. But that's been true for a long time. And for some of the reasons I think that Rob was alluding to, in terms of the more highly educated you are, you have perhaps more experience dealing with paperwork and policies. You might have greater access to information and know how to submit forms, get online, figure out where do you register, or how do you register, and to know that you have to register before Election Day. So some of that is the content and also the skills that come with higher levels of education.
Sarah says on Twitter, white 40s have always voted but don't trust either presidential options and am at a loss what to do this time. Feels easier to skip. Rob, when we look back on the numbers, might we see more of the specific group of voters that we're talking about today having not participated?
It's entirely possible. You know, in any given election cycle, we do see, again, just sort of shifts in how people vote, even if it's just a little bit. I'd say to the extent that we might see turnout drop off this election cycle, mm-hmm. not just among this group, but among lots of people, it might be because of a lack of enthusiasm in the candidates. You know, it's something worth noting that these are the two most unpopular major party candidates that we ever had since we started recording data on this. So that can certainly have sort of an effect on whether people decide they want to go to the polls in November.
Johnny says on Twitter, kind of, I think, supporting what you've just said, Rob, I voted in 08 and 2012. I'm not compelled to vote now. Trump and Clinton are awful. Third-party candidates won't win. So who? Rob Griffin with us this morning from the Center for American Progress and Jan Leakley with us from American University. She studies voter patterns. And we're taking note of an interesting report in the Times about voters who sat out the last presidential election in 2012, who they are, why they don't participate. And then here's another question. And if you fit that, I'd like to hear from you this morning about why it is that you may not feel compelled to vote. Here's another question, though, that I want to get at. Does high turnout really matter? I mean, it's something that we take as a principle. We should all, or many of us, believe that we should vote. But what does high turnout actually get us? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter, at @KerryNPR. I'm also interested in where you both think income and voting behavior fits in here, because it was clear in this graph on the Times that the more you make, the more committed you are to voting, and people with incomes $100,000 or more had the highest participation. So, Jan, why would that be?
Yes, I think here there are a couple arguments that are made that individuals with high levels of income are either more vested in the system, or they have extra time to devote to politics, or perhaps they understand some sense of self-interest better, and so they show up and they vote. That's the one way, though, I think, in the demographic irrelevance, is we know voters and non-voters have different preferences on public policies.
Mm-hmm.
That's a reason to show up if you're poorer.
Take a sip of water there, Jan. Rob, self-interest. Jan mentioned that. So where does that fit in with higher income and higher voting participation?
Well, I think, you know, you do have groups that could maybe more easily make the connection between them voting and the public policies that they see in society. So self-interest could be at play here. But for my own money, I guess what I would actually put it on is probably social expectations. These are people who are parts of communities that have very high expectations for social involvement, for you being a member of your community. As you increase your education level, you have, you know, and your income level, these are people who are probably surrounded by just groups of people who are also politically engaged. So I think part of the big explainer here for me would actually just be the environments that these people exist in.
Well, so you're kind of talking about peer pressure, not mm-hmm. maybe not overt peer pressure, but just the sense that this is what we do if we live in this place.
Oh, I would even say it's overt.
You do?
You know what I mean? I mean, sure, why not? I mean, can you imagine, you know, some of your neighbors, if you talked to them and said, oh, I didn't vote, they might give you the stink eye. You know what I mean? They might look at you a little weird.
I don't know. There's people tweeting in today who are saying, I'm not going to vote. Don't plan on it. Don't talk to me about it, you know?
You know, again, that sentiment exists out there, too. I'm not saying it doesn't. But I think a lot of times you do have groups of people who it's a norm in their communities.
Okay. To the phones to Juan in Minneapolis. Hi, good morning, Juan.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. Tell me what you're thinking about.
I just have an opinion about the voting process.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed that it is very inconvenient for a lot of Latino communities to do it. Latin community, I mean, Latinos have jobs that are very hard. Okay, they have landscaping, they have construction, all these activities that, in the end of the day, you just don't want to go and deal with. You know, and if you go to vote and you see the big lines and people waiting for it and all that, you just want to just go back and go home. I was just wondering why they haven't changed it to like make it more convenient for somebody to do it, like on the phone. I don't know, nap.
Yeah, no. I mean, this is something, Rob, Jan, one of you alluded to, that the system doesn't really lend itself to very easy voting. Jan, were you talking about that or Rob?
Rob identified it. Go at it, Rob.
Oh, sure. So, I mean, in the U.S., I think we actually have a history of trying to prevent people to vote, a very dark history, to be honest with you. So if we want to ask ourselves, why don't we make it easy to vote? It's usually because one of the political parties at one point in history have thought that it was to their advantage to have some group of people not vote. And thus we should make it hard. And that's, you know, that's in the short version of it is that's why we have the system that we have.
Well, Juan was saying at the end there, why can't we vote over our phones? You know, why? There's been a lot of technological advances. I know you've heard this before, Rob.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we vote the way we buy things on our mobile phones? Or, you know, why does it have to be so difficult?
Yeah, you know, so I don't think it has to be. You know, I'm not sure about an app necessarily. There's probably technical hurdles to overcome there, but it's certainly the case that we can make it easier. We could make it the state's responsibility to register people rather than making it people's responsibility to go and register themselves. We can have, you know, multiple days of voting. It doesn't all have to occur on one day where everyone gets in a huge line and has to wait for hours. We can have vote by mail like Oregon does. There's lots of solutions to this problem.
And Jan, I will say this, that Minnesota has just come in with no excuses early voting, you know, making it if you want to vote, you don't have to tell anybody why you're deciding to vote ahead. Do you concur with what Rob says is, you know, there isn't universal willingness to make it super easy for everybody to vote. It's not in everybody's interest to make
Absolutely.
This happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Rob has mentioned, you know, the partisan. There's certainly the partisan factors associated with campaigns, even candidates. You know, their goals in terms of turnout are not to maximize turnout of everyone, but to maximize the turnout of their supporters. And so that necessarily means at least some of these demographic patterns might reflect the extent to which these groups are targeted by campaigns. But I think the other part of this, beyond the partisan aspects of mobilizing turnout and making voting laws easier,
mm-hmm.
right, and more accessible, or modernizing them, or making it, you know, just more convenient. The other part of that is, frankly, a lot of these reforms take a fair amount of money for state and local governments to support them.
Uh-huh.
It is expensive to offer early voting, right?
So,
and the last time I checked, there aren't a whole lot of elected officials who want to claim credit for spending more money on running elections,
yeah.
right? Or when there's a tight budget, not, laying off employees or, limiting what can happen with the election. So that is a very real stress on election administrators who are oftentimes want to do the good things that we're talking about, but resources can be an issue. There has to be that broader political will beyond the partisan.
But I also don't want to miss what I think you've both said, which is it also isn't necessarily in the interest of some politicians, legislative bodies, to make sure that everybody gets a shot at voting. Let's not miss that as well, Jan.
That is absolutely correct.
Okay. Call here from Rachel in St. Paul. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. You're voting this year, it sounds like.
I'm voting this year. I feel like it is not only my privilege, but my responsibility. So I will be voting this year.
What else did you want to say?
Well, I just wanted to say to people to encourage them not to be discouraged, to get out there and vote. And, you know, take in mind this year that, yes, the two major political party candidates are not very desirable. Don't discount the third options this year, Gary Johnson and Jill of the Green Party, because they might just be what we're looking for. I don't know if that's what I'm interested in or not, but, you know, it's a good opportunity for the media this year to cover and get people more interested and for our country to look and see the opportunities that just might be there if we look at different directions, especially since everybody's so discouraged by Ms. Clinton and Mr. Trump.
I do want to say that this show has issued invitations to both the Green Party and the Libertarian Party nominees. They have not yet accepted our invitation. Neither has Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, but I think it would be meaningful to hear from those nominees, except that Rob on Twitter, I just heard from a voter who said, I'm not going to vote for a third party. It's not going to matter.
So, third party candidates don't have necessarily a history of winning at the presidential level. There's a couple of historical examples where parties were in transition. But since the American Civil War, we've essentially had two major political parties that have been relatively stable. So in the sense that you probably won't see a third party candidate win, I think that's absolutely true. But I think, at least in the short term. But I think, you know, one thing people can think about in terms of third party voting, if they're discouraged about that, but they would want to vote for a third party candidate, is that if a third party candidate gets a certain amount of the vote, things start to kick in,
mm-hmm.
right? If they do well enough in the polls, they start to show up in the debates. If they do well enough at the actual ballot box, they can start to get federal funding for their party. So these are things that would still be good for third party movements, even if they don't win.
Jan, would you say something about that?
Yes, I agree with Rob. I think taking it out of the short term, to the extent our busy lives allow us to do that, you know, the parties typically post-election, you know, do the analyses of what worked and what didn't work and what does the electorate look like and what do we need to shift and change on in terms of issues, in terms of how we connect to voters, in terms of expectations. And so I think, you know, the larger that third party vote is, even though it may never approach, the number required to win something at the presidential level, I think both of the parties understand that that's, you know, even if they're just the pressure valve,
mm-hmm.
right, they can, it's a signal that some attention has to be paid. And we do have a bit of a history to see how parties co-opt issues. They might co-opt some voters and respond, perhaps not in the immediate election, but in elections that follow. You can see party positions change and party priorities change.
Jana, I was thinking about what you said earlier about, you know, even if your candidate doesn't win, as with the situation with Bernie Sanders, he has clearly influenced what Hillary Clinton is committing to on some policy positions. But I was also thinking, you know, where does this very low trust in government come in there? Because I think if you ask a lot of voters, if they think candidates say things to get elected, take policy positions to get elected, and then don't fulfill them, I think you'd hear a certain amount of distrust among American voters on that. How do you calibrate that?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it, in this time of cynicism and engagement with the system. I think a lot of it is in part what's reflected in media coverage,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of broader cultural values that go beyond the political realm. And so I think there's a context of what's personal, what's private, what's public, what's acceptable in terms of rhetoric and debate. I think it's also the case that the problems that government addresses have become more complicated over the past 20 or 30 years, right? And so the discouragement that there isn't a solution to terrorism or a solution to the new normal of this changing economy in an international world, you know, I think candidates see the same problems and seek to be responsive to those problems, but it's hard to get easy fixes in this day and age, and that's oftentimes what people want in their lives.
Yeah, you know, Rob, I heard a story yesterday on All Things Considered that really surprised me. There was an analysis about how often presidential candidates actually fulfill their campaign promises, and the average is above 70%. I never would have guessed that. So that kind of speaks to what we're talking about. What would you add to that?
I guess I'd add to it, I guess people can sometimes really fixate on the 30%, you know?
Yeah.
But the
hardest stuff, though,
sure,
probably, right?
Sure. 30%. Yeah, no, I think they're, you know, the president is the most public and noticeable figure in American politics, obviously. And I think there is a tendency for people to imagine that there's a big lever in the Oval Office, right, that goes from good economy to bad economy, or from, you know what I mean, succeed on healthcare to fail on healthcare,
right,
or something like that. But, you know, the truth is that we have a system that's set up where, you know, there's different branches of government and you need their approval, policies made at multiple levels of government, local, state, and federal. So, you know, sometimes when people don't succeed on stuff, that can be disheartening, but it's also a realization that it's bigger than just any one person. That's a failure of a system, potentially, rather than a failure of a person.
Good point. I mean, so President Obama is going to be remembered for many of the things that he accomplished and several of the things he did not accomplish, including immigration reform, not for lack of trying, right? I mean, this kind of goes to your system. You know, that is not something that he could accomplish, even though there were plenty of people, even in the Republican Party, that were well-intentioned on that.
Sure.
If I can jump in,
yeah,
on this,
go ahead,
point,
Jan.
I would add to Rob's, you know, observation about the kind of the institutional complexity and of dealing with these issues and something like passing legislation, that, you know, one of the pieces of that, it's not just the candidates or the elected officials, but it's also the public. And, you know, we have a diversity of public opinion and attitudes in terms of health care reform or energy, and not everyone agrees, right? So there might be a high level, maybe, of agreement about crime is a problem.
Yeah.
But then what do we do in response,
yes,
to that problem,
exactly,
right? And
yeah,
so the public and citizens' different views are a part of what makes it challenging for leaders if they're trying to be responsive.
John says on Twitter, if a voter abstained when last eligible to vote, I refuse to converse with him or her about policy and politics. Go vote. Have a voice, he says. Jeff and Blaine says, I'm not voting this election. I'm not content with the options. I said that while chatting with a group of people, including a veteran who nearly attacked me, said that he was giving away his vote to the liberals and to the phones to Jake in Minneapolis. Hi, Jake.
Hi. I just wanted to go back to something Carrie asked the guest earlier, which is about the implicit value of this conversation.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask why is it always intrinsically good to have a higher voter turnout?
Good.
Especially amongst the group of people we're talking about who are middle-aged, middle-income, white people. Like, why do we need their voice more, especially if they don't feel enthusiastic or informed or don't want to be part of the process? Excuse me. Why is it good for those people to participate more?
Jake, I am really glad you picked up on that. Rob, I'm going to ask you and Jan to think about that for a moment while we get the latest news, and we'll come back and we'll talk about that. I think that's a key question here. If you don't want to participate, then does it really matter that we set these high goals for turnout? What's the implicit value of high turnout? So Jake asks a good question. We'll come back to that. But to Mike Moen now for the latest. And Mike, what are you leading with?
The International Committee of the Red Cross says last night's strike on a Syria aid convoy killed around 20 civilians. The president of the ICRC says they were killed as they were unloading trucks carrying humanitarian aid. The man accused of planting bombs in New York and New Jersey is still in the hospital following a shootout with police that led to his capture. Ahmad Rahami, a naturalized U.S. citizen from Afghanistan, is charged with the attempted murder of those police officers. Federal charges haven't yet been brought against him. The White House says more than four dozen U.S. businesses have pledged $650 million in support to help some of the world's refugees. President Obama will seek to highlight the refugee plight before world leaders gathered for the annual U.N. General Assembly session. The president is speaking right now. A new report says the income gap between black and white workers has widened and that the main reason is racial discrimination. The Economic Policy Institute report says that black men make 22% less than white men and black women make 34% less. The report also found that young black women are being hardest hit. And the stocks are opening modestly higher on Wall Street, led by gains in banks and industrial companies. General Electric rose 1% shortly after the opening bell, one of the biggest gains in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. In the Twin Cities right now, mostly cloudy skies, 61 degrees at the current temperature. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 9:39.
Hi, I'm Chris Farrell. Join me for the next Conversations on the Creative Economy on October 14th with Joanne Jenkins, CEO of AARP. We'll discuss the mission and the business of ARP. Get your tickets now by going to nprnews.org/creative economy.
You know, we have a lot of conversations about politics and all kinds of other stuff. I get it. You can't always hang out and listen for our in-depth discussions, but get this. Those conversations always ready for you on demand on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller in iTunes or wherever you get your podcast and you'll be all set.
Support comes from Tri-State Brain and Spine Institute, specializing in minimally invasive spine treatment as well as exhausting all options before recommending surgery. Information at tristatebrainspine.com, where you see the surgeon the first time, every time.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
Hey, if you're coming into the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul tomorrow night for Talking Volumes with Carl Hiaasen, hearing a forecast that's saying something about heavy rain, I'll just suggest that you leave a little early, you get there a little early. I'll be hanging out in the audience. We can chat, we can have a couple of drinks. The show starts sometime a little bit after 7 o'clock. And if you don't yet have tickets, we have a few left. You can buy them at the box office. Not many, so get there a little earlier. That's Talking Volumes tomorrow night at 7 o'clock with Carl Hiaasen. Back to the conversation this hour. Jan Leakley is with us. She's a professor at American University and the author of Who Votes Now? And Rob Griffin is with us from the Center for American Progress. And I'm just going to put this out one time here, Rob, before we get to this. As you hear kind of our conversation evolving here, I'm curious about what you think about whether high turnout really matters. What's the argument for and not so much? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Rob, what would you say to that?
So I think there's sort of two answers to that. One, I think, is that on sort of a systems level, Hopefully higher turnout means making the electorate more responsive or making the electorate more representative of the actual population. And then hopefully you have elected officials who are then more responsive to that more representative electorate. So let me just give you an example here.
Okay.
18 to 29-year-olds, most people would not know this, actually make up a larger percentage of eligible voters than the 65 and up population.
I do know that, but they don't turn out like the 65 and up.
But they don't turn out. Absolutely. So it goes from like 22% to 15% of actual voters. 16% of actual voters are 18 to 29. You know, but I mean, the truth is that 65 and up, people who are older, they are very well represented in the United States, and it's because they turn out to vote. So if you're interested, you know what I mean, if you're thinking to yourself, why should I turn out to vote? Even making, you know, your demographic group, whatever it is, a larger part of the electorate means that people are going to be more responsive to it over time.
Yeah, Rob, this is the reason why we hear that changing Social Security is the third rail of politics, right? That cohort votes, and if you're going to mess with Social Security, you better be prepared to confront a voting group that turns out.
Absolutely. And they're very well organized, too, through interest groups.
Yeah.
And I think just the one other thing to talk about in terms of just effects. So there's this systems level thing, which is sort of more abstract and it's harder to put your teeth into. But I think even on a personal level, you know, there's evidence that we have that voting, just even the act of voting, increases people's sense of trust in government. It increases their own sense of efficacy in their life and their ability to change their environment. And overall, that's just a better state of being, ultimately, a little bit. It makes you a little bit happier as you go through your life.
Jan, come in on this.
Yeah, I was going to offer the same observations that, indeed, 100% turnout would be, you could argue, 100% turnout would not be essential. We could have the presidential election with 1,000 individuals or 1,500 or 3,000 by random draw if we had a representative sample. So going to Rob's first point of...
that sounds frightening,
you know,
Jan.
I mean, well... But if it's a representative sample of the policy views and the demographic groups, then those 1,000 people could take time out of their day and cast their ballots, and we could conclude that or believe that the election was representative, those decisions that were made. But in fact, we know that the people who vote and the people who don't vote have different preferences on some policies. And so the whole representativeness, responsiveness aspect that Rob identified is true. And so the normative argument, or there is a normative argument, or perhaps just a more, to me, conceptual argument about what living a full life means. Right, and how we as individuals in society and our political system engage and interact, and that by an individual being engaged in the system, brings them advantages or benefits through a better understanding of the life that they are living and the world that they live in, and they're a more active, engaged person, and that's a good thing for all of us.
Rob, one note here before we go back to the phones. I was reading the piece that you wrote, you and your co-authors wrote last year about the importance of women of color as voters. And you said women of color, especially African-American women, are becoming a larger proportion of the electorate. Women of color's growing influence becomes clear when comparing recent voting and registration numbers with those from the 60s, when the Voting Rights Act and other key legislation increased ballot box access for African-Americans and other people of color. Here's what I wanted to ask you about that. Do you see, as with what we were saying about older voters, 65 and up, do you see the candidates, and not just for president, responding to concerns from a cohort of voters that are becoming increasingly influential?
I think I do. I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton has the policy positions she does for a lot of reasons. But, you know, she's probably a candidate that has the most pro-women policies that we've had ever in, you know, U.S. politics.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say the increased influence of women, because there has been a divide. Women have started making up a larger and larger percentage of the electorate over time, is probably part of the reason behind it.
Call here from Kimberly in New Market. Hi, Kimberly. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
I think that in your discussion, while it's very interesting and relevant, you're missing a big part of it in that it's not necessarily about the number of voters that turn out, but how informed those voters are. And I think, you know, the Brexit example of this is perfect. And what we don't want to see is the people voted to leave the European Union, but then the very next day, the most Googled term was, what is Brexit? What is the European Union? So it's one thing to show up and vote, but if you don't really understand what you're voting for, then, you know, essentially, does it really matter?
This, I'm glad you raised this, Kimberly. Jan, this takes us down the slippery slope of some kind of a civics test before you get to vote, which we don't have. But you often, when in an election year, you hear some voters making this argument. What's the answer to that?
Well, I think ultimately in thinking about how an individual casts their vote, to suggest that there should be a requirement that individuals have information, a particular type of information or level of knowledge, you know, that we're better off, is challenging to think about what that means for who can best determine their own self-interest and whether that's independent of information. The old civics tests, you know, administered to people, you know, are an extreme version of this, right? And what we actually know from voting behavior is that even though voters don't have a lot of, may not have much in the way of textbook knowledge or detailed understanding of policies, that there are actually a wide range of shortcuts and cues that voters, regardless of level of education, regardless of textbook knowledge, that they can often use to make what are probably reasonable decisions on that, in a purer sense of the best choice for them.
You know, Rob, I was talking about this with Joel Stein, who writes that humor column for Time magazine. And he was saying, he was kind of making the argument that older voters shouldn't get to vote because they vote on the past, they don't vote on the future, and they're not going to be affected by the future. Kidding, of course. But one of the things he did say was that in California, you have all these referendums, and the voters have no idea about what they're really voting on. And so it's just a bunch of uninformed and you know, legitimately so, voters who this is kind of the extreme of representative democracy, and it hasn't worked out.
Yeah, and I guess I would say that would be a strike potentially against direct democracy, right, against referendums rather than against a system of, you know, saying who should or should not vote. Just to rewind it just a little bit, though, and speak to the caller's concerns. Something I'm always worried about when people start talking like this is the fact that some of the darkest periods in American history revolve around the idea that we're disenfranchising certain people, mm-hmm. and we're telling them that they can't vote and that they shouldn't vote. So that's always a bit of a cautionary tale for me when anybody starts setting restrictions on maybe who can vote or who should vote. I don't think there's a really long lineage of us doing that sort of thing right. And part of the problem is who gets to judge. Right.
Right.
Who gets to be the person who says, no, you're intelligent enough now? I think a lot of people, even when they're making this educated voter argument, are thinking to themselves, well, I'm an educated voter. Well, let me tell you, if I wrote a civics test, I bet you that any number of people would not pass it. Me on a bad day, I might not pass it. Right. So, you know, I think drawing that line is such a it seems intuitive maybe in some ways, right, that maybe we should do something like that. But I think once you try to put it into practice, it becomes extremely dangerous.
Yeah. Linda says on Twitter, we can vote. She means Minnesota voters. We can vote for about 6 weeks now. No excuse for people to not vote. Election day is now only the last day to vote. And a lot of people are calling to remind us that we have same day registration. Yeah. I mean, basically in Minnesota, there are few, I'm trying to think of any barriers. There are few barriers to finding the opportunity and the time to vote because the voting process goes on so long. Call here from David in Moorhead. Hi, David. What are you thinking about?
Well, I've read several studies on from the American Journal of Political Science saying that negative campaigns can reduce voter turnout. I was wondering if your panel there has any suggestions for those that work to get out the vote.
Okay.
How they can combat that voter turnout reduction.
Good question. Jan, what would you say?
That's a tough one. I'm not sure what papers you're referring to there. I think the
He's saying negative campaigning.
Right. There's actually some more mixed evidence. A kind of a broader context is that while people say they don't like negative campaigns, there's also some research that suggests some of it or some types of it actually increase voter interest and involvement.
Really?
So it's a little bit more nuanced than what you might expect. How you flip that coin, Rob probably has a better idea, how you flip that coin and emphasize the positive, right? I think we have, I'm not sure what that flip side is.
Rob, what would you add?
Well, so I think the caller's question was really about how can you counteract the effect of it? How can you get people interested?
Exactly.
So if in fact it is the case that negative campaigns lower turnout, and again, there is mixed evidence about that, how do you counteract it? And I'd say, campaigns have been figuring out this themselves. And, a big part of it is just knocking on people's door and asking them if they're going to vote. It sounds silly, but actually there's a lot of experimental evidence that getting out in your own neighborhood, knocking on people's doors, talking to them about the election and asking them if they're going to vote, it helps actually with voter turnout quite a bit.
This is why political reporters watch ground operations very carefully in the presidential, well, in any kind of campaign, but especially in the presidential campaigns, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, so this has been something that campaigns, for a while, what happened is essentially we started getting TV and campaigns turned away from ground game operations because they started thinking to themselves, we can reach tens of thousands of people and this has cost way less money and there's less logistical nightmares and all this other stuff. And then what they found out later is that these ground games actually have a pretty big impact and these TV ads, maybe less so. So they've returned to doing this stuff.
And Rob, isn't this why, like, the Obama campaign became so effective at micro-targeting? Right. I mean, they were zeroing in very small voter niches in different states.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, some people what people sometimes think is like, they know what houses to target on the street. And in fact, they know which people in which houses to target on the street, which is
right.
A little bit different.
Tweet here from Laura, which is a good point. She says, please note that 5% going to the third party gets them federal funding. Good to remember in a blue state for Bernie supporters. And to the phones to Simon in Wisconsin. Hi, Simon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm actually an Australian, and we have compulsory voting in Australia. But we have about 98% voter turnout, and therefore the government gets more than 50% of the eligible voters voting for them, which gives them a mandate.
Yeah. I just want to, what happens if the government finds out that you have not voted? Are you fined, or what's the deal with that?
I am actually fined because I live here in America. I'm fined $20. I've never actually paid it. It's never actually been chased up. You're obliged to turn up to the polls and get your name ticked off with an ID, of course. But I'm just going to mandate, like, if your president takes you to war, in the name of your country, and only, say, 1 in 4 people actually voted for that president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jan, I think this is a really good question. What do you think? Mandatory voting. We've talked about it before on the show.
Right. It works. Of course, it conflicts dramatically with most, I think, of the types of values that we see in American politics. And so don't expect to see that soon in your local neighborhood. But I think part of what it does is it imbues each part of the system with, elected officials, candidates, voters, with a sense that this is something we're all doing. There's a norm that gets established. So as Rob referred to as voting being a habit and trying to get young people and others in the habit of voting, that expectation and the strong legal norm that it is a law that you have to vote, could be enough to push some notable sections of non-voters maybe over the edge. If the other elected officials and candidates, I think, take advantage of that and work with that to support and make it a systemic approach to getting individuals to make that effort.
Rob, what do you think about what Simon said about it sends a strong signal to the prime minister of the country or the leaders to say, this, you've heard from almost all the voters, and this is what we want. Follow our principles here.
Yeah, no, I think it systems like that where you have compulsory voting and as a result very high levels of turnout, it helps us avoid these situations where people think that there's not a legitimate government in office, right? This happened a little bit potentially around George W. Bush because he lost the national popular vote, but he won the Electoral College. And this creates sort of a bit of a pressure point in society where, you know, it has to resolve itself, where they're not just thinking, I don't like these policies. It's like, I don't like these policies, and this person shouldn't be in office either. So I think a system like that doesn't necessarily have to be $20. In fact, it could probably be any amount of money. It's just really the signal more than the actual amount of money would, you know, really help deal with something like that.
Oh, I want to squeeze Jenny in here from Minneapolis. Jenny, thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, I just wanted to remind people that even if you don't care about or don't want to vote for president, there are a lot of local issues that really directly impact our daily lives, and we ought to think about those as well in voting.
Yeah, Jan, I think this is a good point, that what the state legislature does, what your county commission does, you may end up, you know, realizing more of the results of that than you do in electing a president, even though so much of the focus is on the presidential race.
Absolutely. We give all of the coverage and the excitement and drama of the presidential race, and which can cast a shadow over these other elections where any individual who decides to vote is more likely to be decisive, and it's more likely to make a difference, and they're more likely to be personally connected to candidates and to be able to engage in their community in that way. So that down ballot, if you will, is incredibly important, and unfortunately we overlook it too much.
I want to ask you both for your prediction on voter turnout this time around. Since this presidential race has been as chaotic as it has been, and you've both mentioned the unfavorables of the candidates, Rob, where do you think that turnout will land?
So I think it'll probably be lower than what we saw in 2012, but it'll probably won't be lower in the swing states. There's a lot of money coming into these states by the campaigns. Hillary Clinton has set up a very impressive ground game. And I think chances are she'll be able to sort of keep turnout up among her constituencies there.
Yeah. So to be clear here, when the money comes in, again, that's people on the ground getting people out to the polls.
Sure.
For
and
that
then
candidate.
And then also mailers and TV ads and the whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah. Brace yourself for the last 7 weeks here.
Rob, the poor people of Ohio.
That's right. Jan, what's your take on that?
I agree. That distinction, the key is if you're looking at a battleground state, that's where the organization and money will be, and that's where things are decisive. So I think that turnout will be higher. And other states, Rob could be right, the same or maybe a little lower.
Hey, thank you both. Really good. I'm really grateful to have your insight and your experience on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.